Here we are, Mum. Buckingham Palace.
Again? I'm sure we were here not that long ago.
Ah, but this is the Buckingham Palace of the future.
Is this a terrible, dark, dystopian future, Latimer? Because I don't think I can cope with that right now.
No, Mum. We've skipped over that bit of the timeline. After a miserable decade or so, the Queen finally lost her temper and took power, ushering in a new utopia.
Is absolute monarchy really a utopia, Latimer?
You've often argued that it is, Mum.
Yes, but that was if I was Queen.
Would you like me to arrange that for you, Mum?
Oh, what an interesting question. I think...
Tea and Jeopardy with Emma Newman. There's always time for a nice cup of tea and a spot of mild peril.
Well, hello there, my lovelies. I do hope you're well and haven't had to justify your love of genre to someone annoying in the mainstream press. I'm Emma Newman, and I'd like to welcome you into my secret tea there for polite conversation, abject geekery, a cheeky bit of cake, and of course, a nice cup of tea. It seems that the Buckingham Palace of this utopian future hasn't changed a great deal, aside from the fact that everyone seems to be smiling more and the air is fresh and clean. We're in the blue drawing room this time, and it's just as splendid as the white drawing room was. Let's make ourselves comfortable whilst we can.
I'm sorry to disturb you, ma'am, but your guest has arrived, a Mr. Jasper Ford.
Splendid! Let's see his calling card. Oh, it's made of steel and Jasper Ford is etched into it.
Indeed, ma'am. Mr. Ford has a peculiar fear of being a victim of spontaneous human combustion.
Well, this isn't going to stop that happening.
Yes, but it will make him readily identifiable, should it happen.
Show him in, Latimer.
Very good, ma'am.
For those of you who don't know, Jasper Ford is a novelist who's written books in multiple series, including the Thursday Next novels. The first of that series, The Air Affair, has been translated into over 17 languages.
Mr. Jasper Ford, ma'am.
Hello, Jasper. Do come and sit down. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you.
Would you care for some tea?
I would love some tea.
How do you take your tea?
With milk and a very small amount of sugar.
Marvellous. And is some English breakfast tea?
English breakfast. Or do you have Cornish Elevenses tea?
Cornish Elevenses?
Yeah, or Wales dinner tea. Do you have Welsh dinner tea?
We have Welsh dinner tea.
Oh, well, that yes. I'll have that then.
Yeah. Would you like some strawberry and cream fudge?
I would very much like strawberry and cream. This looks very good, I must say.
It's very, very nice fudge. We brought it with us from Wells in Somerset. It's very, very nice. Mm. Now, I hope you don't mind the chickens over there. You're not allergic to chickens.
No. I'm absolutely fine with chickens.
Marvellous. Now, in my invitation, I asked you to bring a curio with you. What have you decided to bring today?
Well, I'm still eating the fudge here, but my curio, which I happen to have with me, and it's sitting on the table over there. Well, it's an interesting little device. I'll tell you what it is. It's a large format camera, but it's homemade, and it allows me to take pictures of, you know, about sort of 200 megapixel sort of pictures on film in the old sort of fashioned manner.
Oh, wow. Can I pick it up?
Yeah, okay? Absolutely. Have a look through a viewfinder. So it's actually it's a very wide angle camera, as you'll see looking through the viewfinder.
So where do I look through?
Well, you can look through here, or you see, that holds the film. You take the lens cap off and you open the shutter and then look on that screen there and you've got old-fashioned live view, which is upside down.
Wow.
In living colour. You know, and there's no batteries, there's no USB, it's living. So, ladies and gentlemen at home, my interlocator is actually looking at a ground glass where an image has been projected by a lens.
Wow! And there's no batteries or anything?
No, nothing at all. That's a wonderful little optical principle that's been known for many, many years.
Yes!
Long before there was any way to actually record the image.
So this is actually quite heavy. This is not something you want to hold
no,
up for
it's,
a long
it,
time.
It is quite heavy. But it just takes beautifully fine grain photographs, the most amazing detail. And I've loved photography for many, many years. And I particularly like those sort of old-fashioned Ouija-type photographs, which are shot on old press cameras, big 5-4 negatives, uh-huh. and they just have so much detail, the beautiful level of sort of intermediate tones of grey, because I always shoot in black and white. So I'm trying to emulate that a bit, really. I might take a picture of you later, actually.
Oh, I'm not sure about that. Maybe the room. The room is so beautiful.
That is true. It is very, very beautiful.
That is really quite remarkable.
There we go.
Said it's homemade. Did you make it or did someone else?
No, I made it. I used to, many years, I spent, I'm just putting the film back in. You can hear it.
That's a very satisfying
It's a very and you can actually, I can actually just do the shutter for you here. Let's put it on a second of exposure and...
Oh, yes.
It's kind of nice, isn't it?
Yeah.
Very satisfying.
Yeah,
very
satisfying.
All
yeah.
clockwork and analogue and
wow.
things. I used to, years and years ago, I used to be a camera technician, and the whole photography, camera technicianing-y thing kind of is still with me in a
yes.
big kind of way. So I just, I make cameras for a hobby.
I think that's really remarkable. And it's also nice to know that when the apocalypse happens and we no longer have any batteries or power, you'll still be able to take pictures of our misery.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So I am there to document the zombie apocalypse.
Yes.
Did you say apocalypse or zombie apocalypse?
I said apocalypse. Do you know something I don't know?
Okay. I don't want to frighten you, so I won't say no. I've heard nothing.
Nothing.
Nothing at all.
Good. I'm not going to stockpile all the tea at all.
New tea and fudge, maybe. I'm not saying there's going to be a zombie apocalypse, but I just say I think probably now is a good time to stockpile fudge and tea.
You mentioned about the cameras, and I've heard a rumour that you worked on the film GoldenEye.
Yes.
And that you had a role as a focus puller. I was wondering
yes.
if you could describe
I love
that.
It when people say focus puller in that kind of way, that like it's a made-up job, you know,
like or dolly grip.
Yes, dolly grip or clapper loader. What yeah. do clapper loader do? And people always enunciate it, you know, when they say, I was a focus puller. I did work on GoldenEye. More famously, I suppose, is that, I mean, GoldenEye, you know, it was an okay Bond film. I did quite a lot of films, worked on quite a lot of movies in my 20 years, but my claim to fame is I worked on the film that is actually on most people's top 10 worst movies ever made.
What?
Which was Highlander 2. Exactly.
No!
Yeah. Do you know Highlander 2? Have you actually seen Highlander 2?
No, I think I have, but I think I've actually blocked it from my memory
yes.
because it was so awful.
Yes, yes, yes. And I worked on that movie.
And did you know at the time how awful it was? Because I always wonder if people have an idea when they're in a production and nothing is as it's going to look at the end, whether you have an inkling.
Highlander 2 is an interesting one because it was Russell Mulcahy was directing, who directed the first Highlander, which is an excellent movie.
It is.
It's tremendous. We could also say Razorback. Have you ever seen Razorback?
No,
that was Russell's previous one that he made in Australia about a giant, this is a great one, it's about a giant hog that goes and attacks people and kills people. And basically it's like a sort of huge great razorback, you know, it's like, uh-huh. you know, wild boar the size of a tank that like goes through buildings. It's like totally mad and no one knows about it, but it's a Russell Mulcahy film that no one knows about. Anyway, he said, great, you know, we make Highlander 2, you know, and Christoph Lambert said yes, and then Connery said yes, you know, and everything kind of looked good. And then things began to sort of fall apart at the seams, and there wasn't any money to do this.
No.
And they were pulling pages out of the script. And then all of a sudden, there was no money at all, right? The money had finished, right? There was nothing in the coffer, you know, it's like a couple of bent coins, right?
Oh, no.
And then because it was a guaranteed film, because you have insurance guarantors, film is getting very technical here, but you have guarantees for films. So you have an insurance. You know, and you say, okay, you know, if it all goes completely wrong, the insurers will come in and they'll finish the film. So the people who put their money up will get a film and there is sort of some money coming. Anyway, so the guarantors took over and they basically sort of said, right, okay, what do we need to shoot to be able to have, you know, 90 minutes with Connery in it? We'll shoot that, edit it and, you know, bang it out and hope for the best.
Oh, that must have been so soul-destroying.
Well, I think it definitely was for Russell. I can't speak for him, obviously, but I think it was. It is, because when you're a filmmaker, it's like, it's also the frustration about being an author sometimes, is there's the there's the film and the book and the painting and everything that you want to make, and then there's the one that you can make, you know? And I think it's particularly frustrating for filmmakers because there are so many things that can go wrong. Right. With us authors, we can only blame ourselves
if
things don't go right.
Depending on hundreds of people every day.
Absolutely. But with filmmakers, immense frustration because there's so many things that go right. You know, a cyclone will come and destroy your set, or, you know, you can't get the leading man out of the Winnebago, or something, you know, desperately awful goes wrong. You know, and that it just all went wrong on Highlander 2, sadly. But I saw the original script, and I think I've still got some of the storyboards somewhere. And yeah, there were battle scenes, and it was you know, and all that. But men of Zeist, you know, it didn't sort of go very well in the end. But you know, there it is, and it's now it's up on the list of like people's top 10 worst movies, and I was there.
You were there.
I was there.
You saw it happen.
What a focus puller does is. So my responsibility is the camera. So technically, it's a nice technical job. And for me, who loves cameras, it's a lovely technical job. So the camera is my responsibility. Mm-hmm. You have to lace up, put the film in it. In the old days, this is, you know, in the film days, you have to lace up it all, you know, put the magazine on, put the lens on, filter, you know, matte box, all those sort of things. You have to switch it on when you're filming, which is kind of a really important job, really, really important job. You know, switch the camera on. And then when the actors are acting in front of it and they move towards the camera, or there is a focus move, when, you know, when you've seen when someone looks over their shoulder and the focus gets thrown into the background and then they turn forward again and the focus comes back onto them, that is a focus puller. And it's not a job that can be mechanized. Because I've got my eye on the artist, right? And if you've got the dolly moving at the same time and you've got all these moves and everything, you just have to pull focus. And I can't look through the camera, you see. So I've got to do it from the scale on the lens.
Oh, my goodness.
So if someone's 8 feet away, right, I read 8 feet on the lens and set it to 8 feet. Because if I'm looking through the camera, which I can't do anyway because the operator is doing it for framing, once it's out of focus, you see, it's no good.
Yeah.
So I've got to keep it in focus by preempting it. And it's a very skillful job and still is.
I love things like this where you have like an insight into an entire universe that happens kind of just below normal awareness.
Yeah.
And you know, I must have watched hundreds of movies and I had no idea.
Well, you look again. Look again and you watch the focus shifting around. And when you're a focus puller, of course, you notice all the really bad focus pulls. You know, and you go, oh dear,
dear.
But if you really want me to ruin the film industry for you, next time someone comes through a door, right? If the doors are opening, they open a door and they leave the door never swings back. Right? Have you ever noticed that?
Yeah,
the door opens and it stays open.
Yes.
Okay, there is a prop man on the floor holding the door with his finger to make sure it doesn't swing back. And every movie you see, if you go and see a movie from the silent days in 1924 and a door opens and it miraculously it stays exactly where it is, and you go, there was a prop man down on the floor then.
Yeah, I have genuinely wondered about that.
Yeah, that's why doors do not swing back in movies, because there is a prop man. And if he's not actually there, actually, you know, under the frame, which is usually the easy way to do it, then there's a little fishing line on the door.
The doors, is it because just, well, you don't want the extra movement?
No, you don't want the movement, and it will just swing back in front of camera, or just sort of, you know, just annoyingly swing back, you know, so it's right next to the actor's face.
Absolutely. I love that when you start to really, really dissect film and how just unreal everything is.
Totally.
It's so good at tricking your brain into thinking that that's the way things are. It really isn't.
I mean, because if we lived in a movie world, you'd step outside and a taxi would pull up, wouldn't it? Wouldn't it? Straight away.
There was a phase where I was really bothered by people arriving at places in cars and dashing out and not locking their car. And I was stop that. Someone's going to steal your car. And it really bothered me.
And they've always got the right change, or they never wait for change, do they? Or they just give them like $20 and, you know, they'd never wait for change.
Yeah.
And also, and this is one, that if you want to get from one part of a building, right, you just go through the ventilator duct, don't you? And it always takes you to where you want to go.
Yes.
And there's never a big fan in the way where you go, oh, for goodness sake, how am I going to... No, you just walk, you just go, you crawl straight away, and it's light inside, and they're not light inside.
Yep.
And you end up exactly where you want to be.
And there is always a hatch at the top of the elevator.
There is. Yeah.
And that drives me insane that they aren't there in real life.
They're not there in real life.
And every time I get into a lift, I look up and it narks me. Just that little bit that it's like, well, what am I going to do if there is a disaster? How am I going to climb out? They even had it in Star Trek Next Generation.
And what? They climbed out?
Really? There's a turbo lift. There's this episode where they do like a disaster movie episode that is quite ridiculous, but I have a real soft spot for it. And Captain Picard is stuck in a turbo lift with three kids. Which is hilarious because he hates kids.
Mm.
And even that turbo lift, all those hundreds of years in the future, has a panel at the top that you can unscrew, and that's how they escape.
I always thought turbo lifts worked on another principle entirely.
They totally do, yeah.
If it's like some sort of warp principle, because you can go anywhere. Because it goes sideways, doesn't it? I mean,
yeah,
it goes ups and down, sideways, and everything.
If it was about 20 years ago, I'd be able to tell you a hell of a lot more, because I used to know like practically the entire technical manual of version of the Enterprise.
Ooh.
I was seriously into my Star Trek, and I would have told you how turbo lifts work, but I'm afraid that my brain has dumped those files to make room for other things.
Yeah, more important stuff. No, not more important stuff. Other stuff.
Other stuff.
Other important stuff.
Yes, other important things.
Yes, good recovery, Ford.
Okay, now that you've entirely ruined films for me forever.
Yes, yes.
I want to ask you a question about being a very successful author, because you have, well, not you literally have sold, because other people have sold them for you, but literally millions of books that you have written have sold. People are waiting for your next novels.
Mm.
What is it like writing, knowing that there are many, many, many people waiting for your next book?
That's a kind of hard one. I think the thing is that you have to not think about it.
So do you just block it out of your mind completely?
I think it's safest to block it out.
Mm.
And because primarily I'm writing for me when I'm writing. You know, I am thinking about the people who read my books, because there is a very, very subtle relationship between the author and the reader, and things that I said in the first book, which work as, you know, narrative tricks on people who don't know the sort of narrative tricks I play, I can't really do, and I have to then do another trick. So it's like wrong-footing people in a different way, because they...
Yeah.
I don't know, it's a strange one, but if I'd had a character called Red Herring in my first novel, in The Air Affair, they would probably be a red herring, right? But in the second novel, the fact that they're called Red Herring would be the red herring.
Right.
And by the fifth novel, you'd be really confused, because you wouldn't know whether they're called a red herring because they are a red herring, or they're not a red herring, or maybe they are. And it's that kind of weird sort of... connection and dialogue that you're having constantly with people who read, and you're putting little in jokes and stuff like that. But I think, no, seriously, I have to write something that amuses me and that I enjoy and I like, which is sometimes quite tricky. So it's probably best I don't, because then I will start to worry, I think, about, you know, is this the sort of thing that people want to read? And I think if you worry about that, then I always think that it's best to write not to a market, but to sort of almost writing not to market, but to writing to create a market. Does that sound kind of weird?
No, it doesn't. You can't predict a market. You can't preemptively write to something.
No.
Because it's only ever your idea of the market anyway. It's not actually the market.
Yeah, and The Air Affair, which was the one that you know, finally got me published, it was such a weird mix of sort of literary illusion and time travel, and, you know, there was vampires, there was werewolves, there was Jane Eyre, there was, you know, a scholarly discussion of the authorship of the Shakespeare plays. And it was a really kind of weird mix. And the only reason I did it is because I didn't think I was going to be published. And I was just doing stuff that amused me. And I thought, you know, I was reading a book about the Charge of the Light Brigade. And I was thinking, well, I'd like my own Charge of the Light Brigade. And I thought, well, you're the author. You can do whatever you want. And listen, no one's going to read this, because I've had like 27,000 rejections for my other books. So why not? So I just put it in. And then there was this strange sort of Crimean War is still on. And then this very, very strange off-kilter mix then suddenly finds itself with a market, with his audience. So I was not writing to market. And I think that's of vital importance when you're an author, in, you know, working in the genres as a genre author, is to strike out, you know, new and fresh and exciting and stuff like that. And I think, in a sort of very long-winded way of saying, that is why I kind of look to trying to think up new ideas, because it interests me. And I think you know, people expect me to come up with perhaps rather off-kilter stuff, but in a new and exciting and different way, perhaps. That's the plan, anyway.
But you're still not letting the pressure get to you, because that yeah. has inherent pressure, and that's what I find quite fascinating, that there has to be a psychological resilience in you to not have that press upon you. I feel like now I'm trying to convince you to be terrified.
Yeah, it's not really working. You're not frightening me, really.
That's the thing, because that frightens me when I think about that. And I'm fascinated by the fact that it doesn't bother you, that there is such a mental discipline involved in not letting it bother you.
Yeah, I don't think... Well, it doesn't help, you know.
No, it doesn't. My anxiety disorder does
yeah,
not help me.
Yeah. I don't know. But then also, you see, I've just... This is... Yeah, I wrote a book a year for 12 years, right? And it's only when I couldn't do that, because this latest book I've been writing, Early Riser, this has taken me almost two and a half years, and it's going to be like 3 years from my last publication, I think, to this book. And for some reason, this book would not come out. Or if it came out, it came out wrong. And I'm still trying to figure out why it's taken me 2.5 years to write a book that really I should have written in 6 months. And I do not have an answer. Yet. I do not know what went wrong. Something went wrong, clearly. And whether it was me being lazy or I just was tired or something, I don't know. But I think you have to be in this kind of space, headspace. And if there is anything sort of, you know, off around, whenever I have, you know, if there's anything going on, somebody's annoying me, or I've been rude to someone, and I always have to like sort of deal with it. You know, like rude to someone or said something wrong to somebody, and it's, even if it's tiny, it gets in your head like a little worm, you know. Get on the phone, ring up, you know, when I said so and so, and they go, oh, I've completely forgotten. They go, well, I'm apologizing, really? Okay, yeah, whatever, Jasper, get back to writing. And it's like sort of clearing your mind, clearing the decks of your mind to try and be sort of free to do this. But I don't know what happened, you know. And fortunately, I literally finished it within the last day. And I actually quite like the book now.
Oh, good. And did you feel massively relieved?
I did feel massively relieved. And the strange thing is that when I'm writing these books, and I kind of think of my books as, you know, there's a lot of invention in there. There's a lot of bizarre ideas. And I really enjoy putting all these sort of weird, strange connections together. And I really enjoy that. But every time I start a book, I kind of think, can I still do it? Mm. You know? And then I put together a few ideas and I go, yeah, that's great. I can still do it. And that's very relieving for me, but also kind of very exciting in a way. And having finished, this book and added a few little, you know, embellishments and stuff like that, which I really enjoy, I kind of feel okay about it, which is good. And it's it makes me feel, you know, really quite sort of good about, you know, stuff. Not that I don't anyway. But my cousin, Katie Ford, who is lovely. She's absolutely adorable. She's an author as well. Mm-hmm. I was asking her about writing. We have these little conversations, as authors have, you know, because you share these things. It's like, you know, it's like being old soldiers telling stories, you know, about being on campaign, isn't it? You know, your gammy leg. Oh, the hell. Oh, you know, oh, yes. Yeah, absolutely. You know, just couldn't write that book. Awful, you know. And I said to her, do you enjoy writing? Right, because it's a very interesting question to ask an author. Do you enjoy writing? And she said to me, I enjoy having written.
I've heard that from other people.
Yeah, yeah. And I go, that is absolutely, you've hit the nail right on the head. There is something very, writing is great fun, and being in that inventive thing and you come up with nice ideas and that's all working, that's really enjoyable. But once you've done it and you go, yes, okay, brilliant, and you sort of sit back and you go, right, done that. It's 150,000 words and it's all sort of hangs together and I kind of feel happy with it. That's very nice.
Do you find that it's almost like a release valve? It's like something builds up, and then when you have written, whether it's that day's word count or whether it's that body of work, that there is a kind of, like something has been released?
Yes, I think so. It's satisfactory. Yes, it's a satisfaction. I mean, one of the reasons why I enjoy photography so much, and I do painting, and I'm not good at it at all, but it allows me, I mean, I take photographs and then I process them. Mm-hmm. And I take them out of the processor and I look at them, and there is a sense of satisfaction of creation. Mm. And it's the same with paintings. And I do paintings, you know, they're very simple sort of pop artist type things. And I do them and I finish them and I go, right, I've finished that and I've created that and I put it aside. So there is something quite nice about that, the act of creation and having finished something, which I find very nice. But also the other odd thing about this is that having just finished this book is that I am itching to get work on the one that I've also been thinking about for the last 2 years. And it's like there, sitting in my head, and it's going, Jasper, you've got to write me. You've got to let me out of this. You've got to let me out of your head.
Yeah.
And I'm going, yeah, and I'm going to have such fun with that. And Monday morning, you know, without a break, I'm going to get back on the keyboard and go, right, I've got this fantastic idea and I've got to get it out and I really want to write it.
Yeah, I've had so many people say, when I say, oh, I've finished a book, and they're like, oh, you're going to have a long rest. And it's like, no, I'm going to write all of that other stuff that's been waiting in the wings. And it's true.
Yeah.
It's, often they're trying to lure you away like some kind of seductress.
Yeah. And it's like the writing, the getting it onto the paper part is the hard part, you know, and having the ideas is the wonderful,
is
the easy part. Ideas, I could sit down and have ideas like all day and that'd be great. No, then you have to actually write it down and you have to have characters and story arcs and it has to make sense. It has to hold together and all the rest of all those, you know, difficult little things to do.
Which lollipop flavour should exist but doesn't?
That's a very good question. I mean, there's marzipan that doesn't exist as a flavour and it shouldn't. Does that help? Does that help?
Do I detect some...
Or okra? Okra is not a lolly taste and it should never be.
Yeah, so
because
I don't like
okra. I don't know. I'm very fond, oddly enough, I'm very fond of kedgeree and deviled mushrooms.
You don't want to make them into lollipop flavours.
Well,
though,
I think deviled mushroom with bacon as a lollipop flavour, I think it'd be really nice.
Oh, no.
Why? What's wrong with deviled mushrooms? It's
mushrooms,
yummy.
That's what's wrong.
Oh, you don't
with
like
it?
Mushrooms?
No,
what's wrong
like
with mushrooms?
Them. They're really evil.
Do you think so?
Yes.
Mushrooms. I think. Do you know, here, fascinating fact file. Do you know mushrooms are more closely related to animals than they are to plants?
I'm not surprised. They scare me.
They are a bit alien.
They are alien. There's two things I think that has really put me off mushrooms forever. One is the time-lapse photography of mushrooms growing. And it's just like, no, I don't want anywhere near me. And the other is that somebody made me mushrooms once and I like fried them for me. And I had this image in my mind that they were slugs.
Slugs.
Yeah, and I could not shake that. And that association is so strong in my head that it's like, I can't put those anywhere near me.
No, I do like mushrooms.
I don't want mushroom lollipops. That's going on my list of things that must never happen.
What, mushroom lollipops?
Yes.
Oh, God.
Deviled or not.
Or kedgeree lollipop.
Oh, no.
Oh, yum.
No,
kipper,
no, no, no.
Kipper lollipop.
Oh, no.
Oh, I'm on a roll now. Kipper lollipop would be lovely.
Oh, no. You'll be saying jellied eels next or something.
No, I don't like jellied eels. No,
cockles.
Don't. Cockles. Cockles. Yeah, cockles and lava bread actually is quite nice.
Oh, no.
Yeah, if everyone's Swansea, Mumbles Pier. Right.
No.
Yeah, if you're on Mumbles Pier, you have to have the cockles lava bread on toast with a bit of bacon. Well, it's not a rule, but I mean, it's highly recommended.
Okay, at some point in my life, I'm going to go there, and that's going to come back to haunt me, and I'll feel obliged to do it.
Cockles and lava bread.
No.
Cockles and lava bread on toast.
I know you're implanting it.
I am. With bacon. With bacon.
With
and
bacon.
And a cup of tea.
But bacon and cups of tea make most things better.
Yeah, cockles and lava bread.
When we were on the... it sounds really silly. When we were on the cruise, darling.
Yes, the cruise.
Recently, we were on a cruise together. With lots of other people, you know, we didn't just run off and go
No.
We were on the Writing Excuses cruise. And you gave a wonderful talk, which I enjoyed immensely. And in this talk, you mentioned about the use of humble pie as an expression in your household with your daughters.
We're great ones in our house for naming things, you know, giving different names to stuff, you know, like stair mold. If we say, you know, oh, watch out, the stair mold. What it means is the dog is sitting on like the fourth step down, which he does, you know, that's stair mold. But we have, we like scones in my house. I'm very fond of scones. And what we do is we bake one very large scone for breakfast, right? And we call it humble pie. Right, now my daughters, who are 9 and 7, they call it humble pie, and they eat humble pie in the morning as a breakfast scone, but they do not know the other meaning of eating humble pie. But when they do know, there will be this, all of a sudden, there will be this epiphanic moment that there was a little joke that Dad was playing on them for years and years and years. Yes. And do we hate him? Do we love him? I don't know. My feelings are mixed. But it's like implanting a slow burn gag that yes. that you don't know is there.
Yeah.
And it's like a little sort of improvised humorous device.
Yes.
Which is going to sort of just pop in front of their faces. You know, when she's 15, she'll say to someone, you know, hey, you know, we're going to eat humble pie. And you go, what?
Yeah, but why? What have you done?
Exactly. So, I don't know. We have fun.
Oh,
we have
great.
Fun in our house. Yeah.
I also had the extreme pleasure of meeting Mary.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And whenever I have a friend over for tea, I like to ask online if anyone has any questions. And I was quite interested to see that she said, ask him what the collective noun for kingfishers is.
The collective noun for kingfishers?
Yes.
Yeah, is the one, but they're probably, it's probably like a regal or a majestic or
a
something
majestic
like that.
Of kingfishers.
I don't know. But do you know what the collective noun for world leaders is?
I can think of some very bad ones, but go on.
No, it's a lack of principles.
Yes,
do you like that?
I do.
A lack of principles.
I like that a lot. I like the idea that the collective noun for authors is a moan.
A moan of authors. Yeah, a scribble.
Yeah, or a scribble.
I think a scribble.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Every time I end up in a bar with authors,
yeah.
everyone ends up moaning about something.
Oh, do they?
Yeah.
Oh, my God. Yeah, that's why I don't go into bars with authors.
Oh, is it not? We usually have a very good laugh at the same time. It's very cathartic.
Yeah.
You know?
I suppose it is, yeah. Yeah, I don't kind of moan about being an author. I don't know. I always find it very, very lucky.
I find it incredibly lucky. Maybe I'm being unfair. I should say that they moan about the industry.
Oh,
or
right.
About,
okay.
The other aspects of the job, like, you know, the sitting down and writing a book, I adore that. Mm. But everything on the periphery of that, I find really quite difficult and taxing at times.
Yeah.
So
I don't mind any of it, to be honest.
Don't you?
No, I don't.
What about the public appearances?
I don't mind those at all.
You're very lucky.
No, I have no problem with those at all. No, just chatter away. It's like being allowed to. It's like someone coming up to you and saying, "So, Jasper, tell me about your children." You know, and it's like sort of questions that people never ask. And then, because an author talking about their books is kind of like, you know, a proud parent talking about their children.
I haven't thought about it that way.
Yeah,
I usually just want to kind of thrust my book in front of me and say, "No, everything you need is there," and then run off.
Yeah, buy it. Buy it. Money back guarantee.
Yeah. Yes, this is all you need, and run off over the hills.
Don't ask, read it. I like talking. I suppose I like just chatting about books and ideas and things like that.
Mm.
And I think having spent so many years spent 20 years as an assistant, you know, do this, Jasper, do that, and everything, it kind of puts you in a slightly different mindset. And I feel very strongly that people who buy my books and then come to see me, you know, should then have me explaining all about the book and give my utmost to have a, you know, be entertaining and answer their questions and everything else.
Mm.
So I think there's a contract, you know, that I feel between authors and readers, and I try to fulfill it as best as I can.
Oh, that's lovely.
I know. I'm so nice. Mm. Buy my books. So is this, can I do subliminal messages?
No.
Oh.
We're in Buckingham Palace.
Oh,
you
sorry.
Can't do that.
Okay. I beg your pardon. And the other thing about being a focus puller, right, just going back to the focus puller thing, is it means I can judge distances very well, you see. So I can tell you see, that chicken over there is about 8 foot 6 feet away.
That's remarkable.
Yeah. And that's coming towards me, 7 feet now. 6 foot, 5 foot, 3 foot. Yeah, that's about, yeah, you can stay there. Okay. Yeah. Which makes me very useful as a carpet salesman. Basically, because I can measure rooms. I can go into someone's room and go, all right, darling. This is like 10 foot by 8. You know,
are you good at parking cars?
And I'm okay, actually. I'm okay at parallel parking.
Yeah.
But I don't think that's anything to do with actually being able to measure a distance, you know. But it helps with my homemade cameras, you see, because I can just focus them just by looking at the scale.
So we had another question from one of our patrons, and Dom asked, who's a very old friend of mine and is a thoroughly splendid chap.
Hmm.
And he said that he had read that the Air Affair was rejected a huge number of times. That he put in brackets 76 question mark. Is that true?
Yeah. Well, not just the Air Affair. All my books up until the point I was published,
I had
76 rejections.
Whoa. So his question was, how did you retain your faith in the work during what must have been quite a tough time?
I'm sort of pig-headedness, I think, probably. I mean, to put it into some sort of context, that was 76 rejections over 10 years.
Oh, that's, yeah.
Which is only 7.5 a year, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, so that's not that many. No. And it was over 7 books. So you could say it was like one book rejected every year.
Oh, that's actually, when I sent the question, I thought, blimey, if I had 76 rejections in like 3 months.
Yeah, if you have it in 3 months, you go, whoa, you know, should I be doing this? You know, like, yeah, you know,
the jobs.
Yeah, go down the carpet showroom and yeah, I can measure distances. No, it was an odd one, really, because I wrote a book and then I thought, well, I'll send it out to people, publishers and agents and stuff. And if they didn't like it, then I'll just write another book. Mm-hmm. You know, I wasn't gonna waste time, you know, hoiking it around, trying to get people to be interested in it. If they didn't like it, then it probably wasn't very good. And yet, or my writing is not very good yet. You always add yet onto the things. Mm. It's a great thing to do with your kids as well. Oh, I can't do this yet.
Yes, can't definitely.
It annoys the hell out of them. Mm-hmm. But it's actually quite true. And so I just wrote another book. So I wrote the first book, which was the first Jack Spratt novel, the Humpty Dumpty one, rejected. Then I wrote the sequel to that, a sequel to a book I couldn't get published, which is pretty stupid, really. That was the Three Bears one. And then I wrote The Air Affair. And then I wrote another three others after that before I finally got published. So 76 rejections was over quite a long period. But it was also me, I was very conscious that I could have good ideas for books. Mm-hmm. This is what I think I realised fairly early on, and this sort of kept me going, is that a murder mystery with Humpty Dumpty as a victim is a good idea for a book.
Yes, very much so.
Whether I could actually write a good book about it is another matter entirely. Mm-hmm. And I couldn't, you know, to begin with. But I also had this notion that if you practice anything, you'll kind of get better. Mm-hmm. And the words that I were putting on the page, some of them did kind of work. I felt that they did kind of work. So it was me just learning my trade. Mm. I mean, it really was just learning a craft. Because up until that point, you know, I'd hardly done any writing at all.
And that's the thing, isn't it? It's one of those things where so many people assume that you can just sit down and write a book and it is just as skilled as anything else.
Absolutely.
But there's just something in our kind of collective psyche that makes us think that it must be easier than it actually is.
No, it is immensely difficult.
Yeah.
Immensely difficult.
Yeah. Highly enjoyable.
Highly enjoyable. But there's so many things. It's not just about dialogue. It's about everything. Mm. And it's the subtlety of it. It's just in the subtext and everything. It's, sometimes I think authors don't really fully understand what they're doing. Mm. I always think there's like 5%, 10% there that you don't really know what you're doing, but you're kind of just putting it there and it kind of works. And yeah, that's sort of, I don't know how it works, but it kind of does.
Yeah, I'd agree with that.
Yeah, and you put it on the page and you go, yeah, I think that kind of works. Not sure why, but yeah, hey ho.
Yeah.
And it does.
Yeah. I always like to ask my friends that come to take tea what they would consider to be the theme tune of their life.
Theme tune of their lives.
And the reason is because the chickens over there are really quite extraordinary chickens that are very musically talented.
Ah, they are.
They are.
Ah.
And we always like to ask them to sing a song for our friends.
Okay. So, even the one on the right, because the one on the right does not look at all musical, I have to say.
Really? Really no. Musical?
No, it doesn't look musical.
All of them? Yes.
Oh, okay. Yes. Oh, fair enough. Yeah. Theme tune of my life. Well, one of the things I always wanted to do and be that I could never be is I wanted to sound like George Sanders, right? and I don't sound like George Sanders. And for anyone, you know, out there in Radioland who doesn't know who George Sanders is, he's basically the voice of Shere Khan in the 1967 version of The Jungle Book.
Mm,
you know,
voice.
And it has this rich sort of so mellifluous, rich. Fruity kind of, you know, a man cob, you know, all this sort of stuff. And I kind of wanted to sound a bit like him, really. So I guess probably maybe one of the tunes from The Jungle Book or something. But he doesn't sing in it, which is a great shame.
Aww.
You know, but Shere Khan, I mean, he's just great. George Sanders. So the other great sort of, you know, woe of my life is that I never got to work with Orson Welles, you see. I always wanted to work with Orson Welles. Orson Welles, James Stewart and Stanley Kubrick, you see.
Yeah, Jimmy Stewart.
It's just
beautiful.
Oh, my, he's so absolutely lovely, you know.
Lovely.
Oh, Merry Christmas, your old buildings alone, and all that kind of stuff, you know, and, you know. Thanks, yeah. Clarence. And he's just so utterly wonderful. And yeah, there wasn't a chance to work with him. And And Orson Welles died in 1985, so that didn't work out. But I always liked him in The Third Man. So I always kind of think in this sort of notion that I'm perhaps, you know, that I should be more important than I am. That, you know, when I walked into a room, there should be the Harry Lime theme.
Okay.
You know, not that I want to be a sort of, you know, bootlegger who's murdered lots of people. Just that it's kind of cool because there's this sequence in The Third Man. And if anyone hasn't seen The Third Man who's listening, you have to see The Third Man. It's like one of the best movies ever. It's just fabulous. And there's this sequence where he appears in a doorway, and it's one of those wonderful, magical movie moments.
Wonderful. Okay. Yeah. So, chickens, please could you sing, is it the Harry Lime
theme? The Harry Lime theme.
From The Third Man for Jasper, please. And there they go.
That's actually spookily good, isn't it? I wasn't, you know, when you said you have musical chickens, you know, when I've been kind of polite, but I had no idea that they could do that.
So right. There you go. I'll send you a copy if you like, and then you can play it when you arrive in places.
Yeah, if you would, that'd be wonderful. Well, the chicken version or the real version.
The chicken version.
Oh, okay. Yeah, no, I think that could be my version of the sort of Harry Lime theme. Yes.
So you said that you've literally just finished this book. Is that the next book of yours that's going to be published, or is there something else in the system?
No, there's nothing in the system at the moment. Yeah, having not brought a book out for like 2.5 years, there's absolutely nothing in the system. Yeah, so it's called Early Riser. I pitched it as this is my only one-line pitch book that kind of works, really, because all my books are kind of hard to kind of explain in a single line. But this is a thriller set in a world in which humans have always hibernated.
Ooh,
yes, thank you for that. And the optimal word there is always.
Uh-huh.
Because we've always done it, we are subtly different, you know, psychologically, socially, mentally, technologically, meteorologically.
Mm-hmm.
The world is a very different place. So it was really having fun with that idea. It's a great idea for a book, but then you actually have to have sort of characters that kind of have jeopardy and problems and issues and have to make decisions and, you know, have to be called to action, all those sort of stuff. And it took a little while to sort of finesse out the plot. But the, you know, the canvas was written, you know, fairly quickly, but actually getting the plot out was a little bit trickier. But anyway, but that's all happening.
Do you know when it's going to be coming out?
I think it must be the latter part of 2018 now.
Marvellous.
Mm.
I'm just going to check the teapot. Oh, I'm afraid the teapot is empty.
Oh, no.
And, well, we are really, we're taking a risk being here. Even though we are in the future, I'm sure that people might be upset that we are camped out in the blue drawing room in Buckingham Palace.
They'll be fine about it.
I mean, really, what else could you do in the blue drawing room apart from take tea with fabulous people?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah.
But just in case there are any issues in this strange future that we found ourselves in, I think it would probably be best if I said thank you for taking the time to come and have tea with me today.
My pleasure.
And if there is ever any time that you want to come over for fudge and discussing collective nouns in the future, you're more than welcome.
Well, thank you. Yes, I'd love to. Yeah.
So if you follow Latimer, he'll show you the way out.
Latimer, is it?
Yes, okay. that's the button.
Okay, thank you.
So bye.
Bye.
This way, sir.
Well, that was lovely. Why don't we go to the balcony and wave him off?
Very good, Mum.
Oh, that's nice. The corgis have come to see Jasper off and they seem very excited. Hang on. Are they asking Jasper for his autograph?
Indeed, Mum. In this utopian society, corgis are avid readers and, of course, are steadfast admirers of Mr. Ford's work.
I think they admire him a little too much. They don't want to let him go. I wonder if there's something we can do to distract the corgis.
He seems to be doing that already, Mum. He's telling them about people and words connected to whales.
Whales?
The corgi is a Welsh dog, Mum.
Oh, so that's why they seem so enthralled by what he's saying.
He's explaining that the name penguin means white head in Welsh.
How interesting. Jasper really is marvellous. Wait a moment, Latimer. How do you know what he's saying? He's too far away to hear and his back is turned to us.
I took the liberty of bugging Mr. Ford.
Why ever did you do that? That's terrible, not to mention unethical.
There are extremely good reasons, ma'am. Unfortunately, I am unable to disclose them to you.
Well, what's he saying now?
He's offering to show them his coracle.
Oh, how rude!
You are aware it's a small boat, ma'am?
Oh, yes, of course.
And the corgis have expressed an interest. At least, that is my interpretation of "that would be proper tidy."
Oh, yes, he's lifting it out of the boot of his car now. And he's trapped them inside it.
Simple, yet ingenious.
I think we should go before something else happens.
Very good, ma'am.
While Latimer is packing the tea things, I would like to raise my teacup to Alex Tang, Keith Ramsey, Becky Luke Schultz, Brent Medling, and Katina Stewart, the newest members of the Order of the Sacred Teacup. Should you wish to join the esteemed order, go to www.patreon.com/teaandjeopardy. Find us a new tea there, would you, Latimer? I don't mind if it's as fancy as this one.
Very good, ma'am.
You've just listened to an episode of Tea and Jeopardy, hosted by Emma Newman and co-written with Peter Newman. Go to www.teaandjeopardy.com to find previous episodes and www.patreon.com/teaandjeopardy to become a Bless Poppet.